Okay, excellent. Well, welcome. If you've just turned up for this one and weren't here for the last one, warm welcome to you. Hope you've managed to get something to eat. And do feel free to keep on eating as I talk. As has just been mentioned, the kind of format is I'm going to speak for 20 minutes. Any longer, normal rules apply. You throw some food at me, I'll eat it and shut up, okay? Because we want to give you the opportunity to ask questions. And if you don't want to put your hand up, because sometimes that's a little bit scary in a crowded room like this, there is the number up here. And you can text in any point during the talk to that number, and we'll get through as many of those at the end. Of course, the advantage of that is if you find my talk completely boring, you can sit there and text your mates, and I won't know whether you're texting your mates or asking me a question, okay? So you're free to do that, and that's where we're going to go, okay? So looking at the question, in reality, does belief in God cause wars? Which is a really big question, isn't it? Gore Vidal, an American author, said, more people have been killed in the name of Jesus Christ than any other name in history. Christopher Hitchens said, religion poisons everything. It's even a threat to human survival. Oscar Wilde says, when I think of all the evil done in the name of religion, in the name of the Bible, I despair of writing anything to equal it. And Richard Dawkins, quite provocatively, quotes John Lennon and then adapts his song, Imagine, by saying this. He says, imagine with John Lennon a world with no religion. Imagine no suicide bombers, no 9/11, no 7/7, no crusades, no witch hunts, no gunpowder plots, no Indian partition, no Israeli-Palestinian wars, no Serb-Croat Muslim massacres, no persecution of Jews as Christ killers, no shiny bouffant-haired televangelists fleecing gullible people of their money because God wants you to give till it hurts. Imagine no Taliban to blow up ancient statues, no public beheadings of blasphemers, no flogging of female skin for the crime of showing just an inch of it. He says, imagine a world with no religion, and a world with no religion, in his imagination anyway, is a world that would be much better, a much better world to live in. And it's not a particularly new issue, although people have talked about it in the last few years particularly, but this issue's been around for years. So Blaise Pascal, the French mathematician, said, men never did evil quite so cheerfully as when they did so in the name of religious conviction. And so it's an issue that's been around for a long time. And yet I guess this issue, ever since 9/11, has been pressed to the forewards of our public consciousness. And the idea ever since 9/11 is whatever religion you hold to, whether it's Islam or any other religion, if you hold fundamentally to it, if you take your beliefs with strong conviction, then that is dangerous. There was a situation a while back, I was watching a debate in the House of Commons, and the impression was given that any strongly held religious belief would be dangerous. The idea being that the only hope is that we can get people to take their religious beliefs a little bit less seriously in the hope that that will be better for society. And if best, we'll drop them all together. That's what Dawkins would say. Now, a couple of things just to say as we kind of broach the subject to start with. Firstly, a while back, when Richard Dawkins had a series on Channel 4 looking at the subject, it was called, I don't know if you remember, Religion, the Roots of All Evil? And he was looking at this whole connection between religious belief and violence. Now, a very interesting discussion, a very interesting series. Of course, the question I want to ask, first of all, is religion the root of all evil? You know, it's very common to say, get rid of religion, we'll get rid of the problems of the world. But actually, that's quite a naive and, to an extent, quite a short-sighted view of the world, isn't it? To say that religion is the root cause of all evil and problems. Of course, there have been religious systems that have caused violence. But also, there have been systems that have been profoundly atheistic that have also caused violence. So if you look at the last century, two of the biggest movements that caused lots of suffering and horrific violence were inspired, I think, to a large part by atheism. Now, of course, that's not to say that everybody who's an atheist goes and kills other people. It's just to say these things can work both ways, can't they? I do a lot of work in Romania, and I've got some really good friends, some of the older people who live in Romania, who were persecuted physically for the very fact that they were Christians by people who were very clearly doing it in the name of their atheism. So these things work both ways. To say that religion is the root of all evil, well, that's a big question, isn't it? But also, I want to ask this question as we start. What is religion? When we say that religion causes violence, are we talking about all religions, some religions, the seven major religions? See, religions are very different, aren't they? To say that religions are all the same, as we'll think about, I think it's tomorrow in the one of the talks, is actually quite naive. They're all very, very different. Some of them don't even believe in God. Some of them believe in lots of gods. Some of them only believe in one god. And actually, it's also worth saying that even if you don't class yourself as religious, everybody has a worldview. We all have a worldview, whether we articulate it or not, which is a way of philosophy, an idea that makes sense of the world from our point of view. A system of convictions and ideas about the world that we frame things by. And here's the point. It's not just religion that can cause violence. Any worldview of philosophy can cause violence, can't it? Alistair McGrath, Oxford professor, says, when people reject religion, what they often do is they transcendentalize the alternatives. In other words, they take alternative philosophies and put them in the place of religion and can do exactly the same things. So is religion the root of all evil? And what is religion? Those are two good questions to start with. But really what I want us to do in this section is to think not so much about religion in general, because particularly this is part of the Christian Union's events week, and I'm representing this Christian Union as a Christian speaker. But to think particularly about the accusation as it comes to Christianity. When Christians cause violence, why is that? And particularly the question I want us to think about is this. When Christians cause violence, or have, in the name of Christianity, been responsible for violence, has that been consistent or inconsistent with the faith that they claim to follow, with the Jesus whose name they claim? Has it been consistent or inconsistent? Have their actions been natural outworkings of their belief systems, or have they actually been a contradiction of them? That's a really big question. I'll try and illustrate. Silly illustration, by the way. Imagine, you know, next week, events week is finished, and some of the members of the Christian Union have got a bit too much spare time on their hands, okay? Instead of catching up with their work that they've not been doing this week, they decide to form a Queen tribute band, okay? So a group of them get together and they say, guys, I know what we'll do, we'll form this Queen tribute band, and then they're going to play a week on Friday for everyone to come along to, okay? And so they've been practicing Bohemian Rhapsody and everything else. Anyway, they stick up posters all around the university, all around Sheffield, saying that we've got a Queen tribute band, it's going to be on Friday, it's going to be it's going to be here, okay? So they put up all these posters. Now, most of us know these guys from Christian Union, and we know that their musical abilities are limited, to say the least. So we know that next Friday, the place to avoid is this room, okay? We all decide to get as far away from this room as possible, definitely out of earshot. But it just so happens that next week there's a group of Mongolian students on a two-week exchange, okay? And they're walking through the University of Sheffield and they see this poster and it says Queen Tribute Band. They look at it and they say, Queen, we never heard of Queen. Is that the monarch of England? You know, who are they? What's Queen? So they think, I know what we'll do. We'll come along and we'll listen. We'll see what this band are like, okay? So the Mongolians turn up. Now they're the only people here because everyone else is wise enough not to come, okay? So they turn up, they're the only people in the audience. The guys in Christian Union get up to start singing. Halfway through Bohemian Rhapsody, these Mongolian students, they, you know, for the sake of their eardrums, they beat a hasty exit out the door. And as they're legging it across to the far side of campus, as fast as their legs can take them, they're heard to say to each other, Queen are the worst band that have ever walked the earth. Okay? Now here's the question, is that a good conclusion or a bad conclusion that they come to? And of course the answer is both, isn't it? On the basis of the experience that they have had, you couldn't blame them, could you, for never ever wanting to hear anything by Queen ever again. They've heard a very, very bad representation. But of course also they're wrong, because they've heard a bad representation. Queen, well, in my opinion, you might want to disagree with me, we're great fans. But they've made a bad representation and therefore don't want to look any further at what this is about. Now here's the point. I think it's quite possible that often people get put off even looking at Christianity in the person of Jesus. Because in their study of history or their experience of Christianity in different parts of the world, their experience has been so negative that it has caused them not to want to look into it any further. But what I want to say is that in many cases what people have seen is a very bad representation of what Christianity really stands for. And yet historically, and sadly, sometimes today, that is still the case. There will be people who, in the name of Christianity, who will be very bad representatives of the very Jesus whose name they claim. And that's been the case historically. Just think for a minute about the Crusades that come up so often in people's discussions. What was the problem with the Crusades? The problem was that in the name of Christianity, people misunderstood the very heartbeat and the very centre of Christianity. They thought they were claiming to represent Christ, But actually they were doing things in very contradiction of the Christ they claimed to follow. So you think about it. Jesus, in the Gospel accounts, you can take away and read. Jesus, in one of the Gospel accounts, we're told about how he's put on trial. And he stands trial before his own execution. And Jesus is put on trial for the very accusation that people level at Christianity today. That Christianity is dangerous and will cause social unrest. Jesus is put on trial because people claim that Jesus is going to cause social unrest. That his claim to be the Messiah, the Son of God, is going to cause social unrest across the Roman Empire. He's put on trial, and what is Jesus' answer to the accusations that are thrown at him? He says this. He says, "My kingdom is not of this world. If it were so, my followers would come out fighting." See what Jesus says? He says, "I haven't come to set up a political kingdom. I haven't come to spread my kingdom by physical force and violence like other kingdoms are spread." And the tragedy in history is that often people have represented Christianity and yet completely misunderstood that. That they have thought the way to extend Christianity and to extend Christ's kingdom is through violence. Because if Christianity is about falling in love with Jesus and having a relationship with him, you can't force people to do that. See, Jesus says his kingdom is not a political kingdom. It's not a kingdom that's set up by force or violence. People have often misunderstood that. And I would say they've been bad representatives of the very person they claim to follow. It's not a political kingdom. Jesus didn't come to kill his enemies, he came to die for his enemies. But sadly, in the history and in today, there are some people that have been bad representatives. Now, if we go back to our Mongolian students for a moment, you know, we've left them running across the campus as fast as they can to get away from this terrible tribute band. Now, if you were to meet them, and we're trying to reason with them about their experiences. What could you do? You could say, look, you've had a very, very bad representation of Queen, but if you come with me, there's going to be a really good tribute band next week. Because there are some tribute bands to Queen that are better than others. And you could take them along to them, couldn't you? You could say, look, there's a band here, and they'll be a much better representation of what Queen were really like. Okay? It's also worth saying that when it comes to Christianity, there have been very bad representatives historically. But I would say they've also been very good representatives that have much more accurately portrayed what it looks like to follow Jesus. I think sometimes the mistake that people like Christopher Hitchens and Richard Dawkins makes is that they're very selective with their reading of history. So they'll highlight things like Crusades, but actually neglect whole swathes of history where people, in the name of Christianity, and outworking their Christian beliefs, have done things that have been very beneficial and positive for society. So just take two names, William Wilberforce and Martin Luther King. Two people who, because of their Christian conviction, fought to abolish slavery and institutional racism, respectively. It was because of their conviction and because of their beliefs shaped by the Bible that they did what they did. And there's loads of other things in history too. Just think of the legacy that the Christian worldviews has. The introduction of free schooling, the increase in modern science and the development of that, healthcare provided free, and the abolition of child labour. Often, a lot of these things are just neglected and ignored, and yet it was, in many cases, Christians, out of their conviction, shaped by the Bible, that achieved these things. There are good representatives. There's a danger that we can be selective, and we can just highlight one and not the other. We need to bear in mind, there are bad representatives, but there are good representatives. But one final time, let's go back to our Mongolian students again, and let's talk to them again. So look, you've heard a bad representative. You know, forget the guys in CU, they're rubbish, okay? You know, they know enough guitar and music to be able to play Christian worship songs, but that's about it, okay? You know, let's forget that. Now, there's some good representatives, you know, they can hear good tribute bands, couldn't they? But actually, the best thing to do, if you want to introduce them to Queen, is just to go onto Spotify and play them the original, okay? Just say, look, listen to what they're really like. And my biggest encouragement to you is don't just be put off Christianity by the bad representatives. Don't just look at the good representatives. But if you want to look at Christianity, look at the source of Christianity, first of Jesus himself. Look at the original. And look at Jesus and ask yourself the question. As you look at Jesus, would someone who consistently follows this man be a menace and a threat to social peace and society? Or would they be a benefit and a blessing to us? Look at the original. And that's why we're giving away these gospel accounts of the life of Jesus. So that you can do that for yourself and say, what do I make of this man? Because when I look through and I look at the life of Jesus, I see someone who is totally opposed to the idea of religious violence. So Jesus teaches that we're to love our enemies and do good to those who persecute us. There's one instance where Jesus is walking through a Samaritan area. That was a religious and social grouping that were totally opposed to the Jewish people who were most of Jesus' early followers. And they're walking through this area where there's a lot of religious animosity going on. And the Samaritan people reject Jesus and his followers. So one of Jesus' followers has a bright idea and says to Jesus, Jesus, do you want us to call fire down from heaven and destroy them? You know, come on, Jesus. Yeah, let's just wipe them out. Yeah, they don't believe you, let's get rid of them. And what does Jesus do? Does he commend them for their religious zeal? Absolutely not. Jesus condemns them and says, no, you don't know what I'm about. That's not what I'm doing. Jesus doesn't come to wipe out his enemies. Jesus comes to love them. Now, of course, the big question is, if that's what Jesus teaches, what does his practice show? Because we're confronted so often, aren't we, by people who preach one thing but practice another. People are inconsistent. I don't know if you remember a while back, when the kind of environmental issues started to kind of come high on the political agenda, David Cameron started cycling to work. Do you remember that? And it was all the media. You know, David Cameron, the Tory leader, was cycling to work, and this was very environmentally friendly, and everyone thought this was wonderful. And then a few weeks later, we discovered that he had a chauffeur in a car behind him carrying his shoes to the office. And then we all thought, well, maybe it's not quite the same. Someone who gives the impression of one thing, but actually, when the reality is shown, it's quite different. And we've experienced that, haven't we? People who say one thing and practice another. Was Jesus like that? You know, in public, telling us to love our enemies, but actually in practice doing something quite different. Well, look to the end of Jesus' life and see what happens towards the end of the Gospel accounts. And you see that as Jesus is being arrested, and his followers are jumping to his defence, one of them, Peter, with a sword, to attack the people who have come to arrest Jesus, it's Jesus that tells them to put their swords away. It's Jesus that heals one of the men who have come to arrest him. It's Jesus that's loving his enemies that have come to take him away. And then as Jesus is being nailed to a Roman cross, facing physical pain and execution, again, it's Jesus who says, Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they're doing. You see, when I look at Jesus, I don't see someone who says one thing but does another, but I see someone who is absolutely and utterly consistent. Someone who loves his enemies and then dies for them. See, Jesus is so different, isn't he? And I urge you, don't just be put off by the bad representatives that you may have seen or heard of through history, but look at Jesus and ask yourself the question, if someone were to consistently and faithfully follow Jesus, what would that mean for their life? Would that be bad for society or good? You see, go back to people like Wilberforce and Martin Luther King. When they were wanting to stand against slavery and racism, what were they saying to nations who, in a sense, would have predominantly described themselves as Christian? Did they say, guys, you're taking your Christian faith too seriously? You know, stop taking your Bible so seriously, lighten up, and then we will get rid of slavery. Then we will get rid of racism. Of course, it's not what they did, is it? What did they say? They said, guys, you're not taking your faith seriously enough. If you were really to look at what the Bible means and the implications of that, then you'd see what's so horrific about slavery and racism. The challenge was not to be less consistent, but more. See, I think so often the accusation today is any strongly held religious belief is dangerous. Of course, the question is, what is at the core of that belief? If at the core and center of that belief is the person of Jesus, then actually the problem is not that we hold it too strongly, but actually the problem is often that we hold it too lightly. See, Jesus loves his enemies and dies for them. Check him out and check his life out. And so here's the question as we come towards a close. If religion is not the root of all evil, then what is? Okay, if religion isn't responsible for all the evil in the world, why is there evil? I don't know if you remember when George Bush was President of the United States. How can you forget? He once gave a speech, and in his speech he was talking about the axis of evil. It's often called the axis of evil speech. And he talked about various countries, various parts of the world that were responsible for evil and violence. And his theory was, you know, if you get rid of certain places and certain people, then you'll get rid of evil and violence. Actually, Jesus is a lot more look more personal in terms of his assessment of evil. Jesus says the root of evil is not certain places or certain countries, but the human hearts. He says the problem of our world is not certain dictatorships, but actually every single human heart. And the philosopher Solzhenitsyn said the dividing line between good and evil goes down the centre of every human heart. As human beings, we're capable of great love, goodness and creativity, but we're also capable of great selfishness and violence. I was in Burger King a while back. I do try and avoid it. It's not good for your weight. But anyway, I was in Burger King a while back, and you know when you're sitting there eating your bacon double or whatever you get when you go to Burger King, on the tray in front of you they have the kind of the sheet of paper with Burger King and their logo and their motto on it. And I was reading Burger King's motto. You know the motto is "Have it your way." I was reading this and it had this little ditty underneath. Let me read it to you. This is what it says: "Have it your way. You have the right to have exactly what you want, exactly when you want it. Because on the menu of life, you are today's special, and tomorrow's, and, well, you get the drift, that's right. We may be the king, but you, my friend, are the almighty ruler." Now, I always choked on my bacon double at this point, so I thought that may sound very attractive, but actually, that is the very problem with our world, isn't it? And every single one of us goes around saying, "I want to be the almighty ruler. I want to have it my way." Now here's the thing, most of us don't have armies and nations at our disposal, so we don't have the possibility of starting wars. We still have the very real possibility of starting violence, conflict, whether that's interpersonal between those that even we claim to love. Our own selfishness and self-centeredness so often causes hurt and problems. And then put that on a global level and see what happens when nations and nations' leaders start to do that as well. Jesus says the problem of the world isn't just out there, the problem of the world is in here. But actually we also see in the Bible not only the reason why there's a problem with our world, but also we see a solution to it. So we see the God of the universe who creates all things steps into this broken world in the person of Jesus. Actually he experiences violence and injustice. In fact, the violence that Jesus experiences is often at the hands of religious people, people who thought they were being faithful and true to their religion. He faced his physical execution, pain and death. But the Bible also says that it's because of what Jesus experienced that the problem in each one of our hearts can be dealt with. That we can know forgiveness and brought back into a relationship with God. That we can have our lives reorientated around him in the way they should be. That Jesus came to do that. And that because of what Jesus does, as we mentioned at the end of the last talk, that means that there is real hope for this broken world. See, we live in a world where violence, suffering and pain are daily realities. But there are wonderful promises in the Bible that because of what Jesus has done, that in the future there will be a hope of this world being put right. So in the Old Testament there are some prophecies, predictions or promises, however you want to call them, of what's going to happen in the future. One of them, it sounds quite antiquated to us now, but it talks about how in the future people will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Okay? Now that sounds kind of a bit antiquated, doesn't it? But here's the thing. You know, the Bible's saying that one day war and violence will be a thing of history. But one day there will be peace and harmony. And that solution is found because of what Jesus has done. Not by wiping out his enemies, but dying for them. And through his death offering forgiveness and a relationship with him again. Now, I'm aware that what I've said has probably not answered all the questions maybe that you've all got. And probably it's raised a few more questions too. So what we're going to do in a moment is we'll have just a couple of minutes to discuss what we've heard and to think of some questions. Maybe you can text them in if you don't want to put your hand up. We can do either.
Misunderstandings and bad representations aside, people who cause most wars believe in God, right?
Okay, so people who cause most wars believe in God, right or wrong? Well, I guess it's an interesting question, isn't it? I mean, you could try and kind of tot up through history all the people responsible for war and kind of do a body count, which I don't think is going to get us very far, is it? If more have been caused by one or the other, that will mean that we should or should not get rid of gods. Of course, probably interesting to say that historically more people have had some idea of gods, that belief in God has probably been more prevalent than atheism over the years. So it's also worth thinking about that. And of course, what I was saying in the talk wasn't, I wasn't wanting to defend general belief in God per se, but actually particularly the God who has revealed himself in the person of Jesus and asked that question. So I think each philosophy, each religious system would need to kind of grapple with that issue for themselves. But what I wanted to say is that I think consistently following Jesus, would actually lead to great blessing for society, not danger for society. So is it responsible? Who's responsible for more? I think it's worth saying that there is both, isn't there? There have been religious people who have caused violence. There have been irreligious people who have caused violence. Any worldview or philosophy can. But the big question is that violence consistent or inconsistent? If I believe that humanity carries an intrinsic value, not just because we are biologically more complex than the rest of humankind, but because we are created in God's image, if I believe that that value remains today, even though I'm separated from God and scarred because of my sin, because of what Jesus done for me, then the way I view humanity and other people will be necessarily different from if I view that humanity is just an accident. So I think a practical outworking of the implications of a biblical worldview means I have a higher view of humanity and a greater respect for people, even if I don't believe what they believe. Okay? Tolerance, by the way, doesn't mean that we say that everyone is right. Tolerance, by definition, means that we might think that some people are wrong, but we choose to not take it out on them physically or violently. So when I say I tolerate other people, that's not to say I think all religions are right, but it does mean that I say I respect people's right and ability to believe things other than myself. And as a Christian following Jesus, I think I have good grounds to do that, because Jesus did as well. Jesus had people who didn't believe in him, who rejected him, and Jesus allowed them the freedom and responsibility to do that. I should see. That's a great question. Are there any more? Okay, from a religious perspective, how can we define someone as an enemy? I think speaking from a Christian point of view, then Jesus redefines my relationship with other people in a very radical way. So for instance, in Jesus' day, the Jewish people would have naturally seen Samaritans as their enemies. They were, you know, it's a bit like, you know, Southampton supporters and Portsmouth fans. You know, I'm a Southampton fan, you know. Yeah, we just kind of naturally be opened up, they're the enemy. And vice versa. Jesus tells a story about a man who gets beat up on the road down to Jericho. And he says, this Jewish guy gets beaten up, who is it that helps him? And it's the Samaritan. And everyone's shocked. You know, this guy's enemy is the one who helps him. And Jesus tells the story to illustrate the answer to the question, who is my neighbour? You see, the religious people of Jesus' day wanted to define my neighbour as the people who are like me, the people who believe the same things as me. Jesus tells this story to say, actually, the people who traditionally you would have regarded as your enemies are also your neighbours. Now that means to the Christian, people may regard me as their enemy, but I am never to do that back. Actually, even if people persecute or oppose me because of what I believe, then my reaction to them should be one of love, and never one of rejection, and to view them as a neighbour, someone creating God's image, is intrinsically valuable, and not as an enemy to be rejected. That's a great question. Brilliant. Any other questions people have got? Thank you so much for asking that question, but not answering it, you asked it. Because I think that's a really big question, isn't it? And when you come to the Bible, there will be bits of the Bible you'll think, man, that's in the Bible? I mean, like, if some parts of the Bible had an age rating, they would definitely be 18s. Yeah, read the book of Judges. So there's some stuff, you come to the Bible and you think, so I guess the common kind of conception, therefore, is, you know, when it comes to the Bible, the Old Testament God is the God of wrath and anger and judgment and violence, and the New Testament God is the God of love, peace, grace, and everything else. Of course, as a Christian, I believe in the whole Bible, the Old and the New Testament, so I can't just reject the Old Testament to say the Old Testament doesn't count. The Old Testament does count. Jesus treated the Old Testament as part of God's words to us, part of God's revelation. So how am I to respond to that? Well, I think often the idea is, well, it just seems that in the Old Testament you've got ethnic cleansing. You know, one nation coming in, taking a land that doesn't belong to them and killing everyone else. There isn't a simple answer to this, but I think there are a few things that are worth bearing in mind in regard to this question that I think would help us. So just bear with me with a few of them. I think, firstly, when we come to the Bible, I think often we come with the kind of the preconceived idea that we're basically innocent people who deserve God's blessing. Whereas actually the shocking reality is that the Bible confronts us with the fact that we're actually guilty people who deserve his punishments. It's also worth saying that in the Old Testament what's going on is not that God is simply kind of ethnically cleansing certain nations in favour of others. So when we look at the Old Testament, it seems that, you know, it's just one nation wiping out other nations. Actually, the Bible says that what's going on is that God is judging nations because of the evil practices of them. And these weren't just kind of nice, innocent nations that were going on doing their own thing. These are nations that practiced things like child sacrifice and stuff like that. Some of the practices that here were really corrupt. But it wasn't that God was simply snapping his fingers and saying, I'm just going to wipe you out. So we actually see that God waits sometimes for hundreds of years, patiently giving people the opportunity to turn back to him. So God isn't just kind of giving people no warning. He's patiently giving people the opportunity to turn back to him. Nor is it the case that God is just showing favoritism to one nation over and above others. Because actually when God's people, the nation of Israel, turn away from God and adopt the same practices that God has rejected in the other nations, they too face God's judgments as well. And it's also worth saying that when other nations respond to God and turn back to him, they don't face the judgment that is threatened. Okay? So it's worth kind of saying all of that in regards to the Old Testament wars. This isn't just a kind of arbitrary thing that's going on. What do we think, what's the situation today? Well, actually, in Jesus, we find the person who is willing to take the punishment that we deserve because of our sin and rejection of God's. Actually, our rejection of God does carry consequences. But the God of the Bible is a God who's willing to take it in our place so that I don't have to face it, and nor do you. Now, the reality is if I reject what Jesus has done, and ultimately I'll still face that myself. But I don't have to, and no one has to. So I'm sorry if it's a bit of a complicated answer, a bit of a long answer to the question. So it's not a kind of simple kind of one-liner or a soundbite. But I think there's a variety of factors that we need to bear in mind. I think also we need to understand when it comes to the Bible that God is the same God throughout. So in the Old Testament we also see that God is a God of love, grace and patience. Who holds out his hand saying, I want people to come to know me and to come into relationship with me. And that's open not just to one select nation, but to all people. In fact, in the genealogy of Jesus, you see a whole collection of people who weren't Jews by birth, but came into God's people by faith as well. So great question. Brilliant.
Okay.
So if wars are being caused by the misinterpretation of the Bible, why is that happening? Is that the question?
Yeah.
Really good question. Christians often talk about things, so here's a jargon word for you, okay? It's called the perspicuity of Scripture. Now there you go, try that on your mates this afternoon. It just means that the Bible, Scripture, is clear. As in, you don't need a priest or a kind of professional person to tell you what it means. You can read it yourself. You can take away Luke's Gospel and you can make sense of it, okay? So it's not that the Bible is this really confusing book that no one could ever understand. There are some bits of the Bible that are harder to understand than others, that's worth saying. That's one of the joys of being a Christian, that you know, you've got all your life to study it and get to know it. But I think the core message and the core idea is quite simple. So the Bible is clear, but here's the danger, that we can come to the Bible with our own agendas. So the question is, do I come to the Bible wanting the Bible to speak to me and challenge my preconceptions and my ideas? Or do I come to the Bible with all my preconceptions and all my ideas and just use it to back up what I already believe? There's a real danger that we can do that, isn't there? This is what I want to believe, and I'll just twist verses out of context to support my beliefs. I think if you come to the Bible not imposing your agenda upon it, but simply reading it with an open mind, saying, what do I make of this? Actually, the clear message of the Bible is there for us all to understand. So I think actually there are often motives as to why people wanted to misinterpret the Bible to achieve their own political, social, or whatever ends they had. But does that mean that the message of the Bible is confusing and unclear and impossible to find? No, I think you can do it, which is why we want you to take it away and have a read for yourself. But it's a great question. Thank you.